welcome to another episode of What Matters in North Carolina. On today's show, we will be talking with Dr. Bob Lipke for an abbreviated guide for how to answer anti-school choice arguments. We will be going over some of the common arguments that people bring who are against school choice or not very positive to school choice and how to answer those arguments with Dr. Bob Lipke, who is, of course, the education's guru over at the Civitas Institute. Now, before we get to that, I want to talk about subscribing to the show. If you're not already subscribed, I mean, you hear me say this every time we go through a show, but if you're not already subscribed, you're missing out on the easiest way to listen to the show. Go like on Apple Podcasts if you're an iPhone user or some app on the Android system. Podcast Addict is what I use. And you can subscribe to the show there, and you'll never miss an episode of What Matters in North Carolina. Also, follow on social media on Facebook and Twitter at What Matters NC. And you can go to the website and listen to past episodes of the show or other shows on the Freedom Action Network by going to freedomactionnetwork.com. Without any further delay, we will get to our segment with Dr. Bob Lipke. All right, Bob, welcome back to the Freedom Action Network, to the What Matters in North Carolina show. Of course, you've all heard from Bob before. He is Dr. Bob Lipke. He is the policy director for the Civitas Institute and also the education policy guru for the Civitas Institute. So, Bob, thank you for joining us again.
It's good to be here, Matt.
So today we are going to take a different bent. We usually talk about certain policy topics, whether it's school choice or parent choice, as we kind of take into calling it, or whether it's the school grades or some other facet of the school system. But really today we're going to be talking about the rhetoric being used against a school program in North Carolina state school program. Isn't that right?
Yeah, we're going to talk about anti-school choice rhetoric and how it's been ramped up a lot in the last 3-4 months by a lot of people that do not like school choice or parental choice, as we like to call it. And some of the major arguments they throw out there, we're going to talk about how parents and friends of school choice, you know, can respond to some of these arguments.
So this is the abbreviated debate guide for coming back or answering to anti-school choice arguments, right?
That's correct. We don't want to consider this a tutorial because we're going to walk through it, you know, pretty quickly. But, you know, want to give people some ways to respond to some of the major arguments that people that don't like parental choice, what they accuse or what they say school choice does or doesn't do.
All right. So what is the first argument, maybe the most common argument against school choice that people are going to hear?
Well, let's give a little context here. I decided to write these up for today's program primarily because the last couple of months I've been responding a lot to these things and to these issues. And in the last week, I responded to an op-ed by Keith Poston, who is the president and executive director of Public School Forum, who had an op-ed in the News and Observer, which basically said that school choice, you know, that school choice was one of the reasons for the public school budget problems. And also went through, in the op-ed, he also said, you know, that we're expanding these programs. There's no accountability in these choice programs. The money is going to for-profit companies, and we cannot have that happen because we know what happens when actual money goes to for-profit companies, that, you know, then all hell breaks loose. So anyhow, those are some of the major arguments. And also that, you know, one of the other ones I think we need to get to is that there's people who are against school choice, that are against parental choice, put the movement and put advocates of school choice in a very narrow box, you know, unjustifiably, and they basically create a false dichotomy of if you're for school choice, you have to be against the public schools. And we're going to address a little bit also how you address that concern. So those are the basic accusations, I guess, if you want to call them anything. They're accusations that anti-choice people throw to parental choice advocates and try to basically discredit our school choice programs. And one of the first things that we need to address, and that is along the lines of, have school choice programs really taken significant amounts of money away from the public schools? And you have to say no to that. I mean, if all things considered, the answer is no. Let's just deal with some major figures here from the last 5 years. The actual budget for public schools in 2011-12 was about $7.5 billion. What it is now in 2017-18 is about $9 billion. So it's going up. Anti-choice advocates like to talk about how Republicans have, you know, decimated the public schools and so forth. That's not the case. You can look at per pupil expenditures. They're not declining as you would suggest, as would be reflected if that was the case. That's not happening. Actual total expenditures have gone up in the last 4 or 5 years. And so none of that squares with any of the rhetoric. None of it. Now, the expansion of choice has happened because of public demand. We now have 3 school choice programs. We have the Opportunity Scholarship Program, which is by far the largest one, that provides eligible students a scholarship of up to $4,200, you know, to attend a private school. We also have a special needs scholarship, which is essentially a voucher that eligible students can get up to about $8,000 a year to use at a school of their choice. And then most recently, this last legislative session, the lawmakers approved what's called the Personal Education Savings Account, which will provide eligible students up to $9,000 in scholarship funds, which parents can use for educational expenses. Now, we can get into the details of all that at another time, but the point being, all these programs, the programs that were in existence, the Opportunity Scholarship Program and Special Needs Program, are all growing. In fact, the Opportunity Scholarship Program now has budgeted for $45 million this year.
But I have a quick question about, so aren't all of those school choice programs, those 3 programs, isn't the per pupil spending on those programs lower than the per pupil spending for a public school child?
Well, let's not limit. School choice also includes charter schools. In other words, a parent can also choose to attend a charter school. Which, now, to answer that question, let's step into the morass here, because legally the answer to that is, yes, it is supposed to be the same per pupil expenditure in a charter school. Oftentimes, for a lot of technical reasons, it is not, with regards to the local appropriation, what actually happens. But legally speaking, it is supposed to be.
So it's supposed to be the same, but it actually is lower.
Yes, because charters are public schools.
Right.
Now, with regards to the other programs, the Opportunity Scholarship and the Special Needs Scholarship, as well as, in the future, the Personal Education Savings Accounts, the actual scholarship amount for example, the Opportunity Scholarship, $4,200. That's much less than, you know, what would be the average per pupil expenditure, which for a public school is about $8,800.
So it looks like these programs are spending less than if your child is in a public school setting. And for the most part, and wouldn't that be a lot of the chunk of what you needed to argue away that point that it takes away money from the school system? If this kid's not in the school system, I mean, you're talking about charter is a public school, but if this child is not in the traditional public school system as we think of it, you know, as the elementary school down the street that's been there for 10 years, 20 years, wouldn't that go against that argument if they're taking up less tax dollars in another area?
Yeah, you can say that they're saving money because the dollars, the taxpayer dollars that are being used, say in the Opportunity Scholarship, $4,200, in the case of the recipients there, they're being educated at considerably less expense than they would be in a traditional public school. That's also the case in most charters. Most charters can educate traditional public schools at about 70 or 80% of the cost of a traditional public school. So you can say there's actually cost savings going on here. And you can make a legitimate argument that's the case because you can see the numbers and the numbers bear that out.
All right. So what's another argument people use against school choice?
Another argument that's frequently made is that the money is going to for-profit companies. For example, in the case of charter schools, this is one of the points that Keith Postet made, that monies, for example, in the case of the Innovation School District, which is legislation passed last year, approved, that said that the five or six lowest performing schools in North Carolina would be grouped together in a new school district and basically run by a charter management company. Now, the reason that is brought up by anti-parental choice people is it's kind of a red herring. They say for-profit companies, that they must be evil because they're in business to actually make money. This is the problem with this argument, is that it ignores already existing problems. If they say that those conflicts exist, and I would beg to differ that they do, but if they say they exist, they've already ignored the many relationships that existing school districts have with what they call, would call, for-profit companies. Let's look at large computer companies such as Apple, Microsoft, Dell, Oracle. They all have large contracts and have given millions to school districts in the way of services, computers, things like that, that, I mean, Poston and others just seem to turn a blind eye to. Wouldn't they have potential conflicts? I mean, are they just ignoring the things that already have existed for years in traditional school districts? That's the problem with that argument.
So the argument is that there's already these close relationships with for-profit entities that are already going on and are already accepted and not even thought about and blinked at. But then when you talk about handing over these failing schools to a company who is expected to turn it around and make a profit along the way, that's when you cross the line and kind of teasing out the inadequacy of those things.
Well, yeah, they're ignoring inequality, a lot of things that in their mind say exist, you know, elsewhere, but they fail to acknowledge that, you know, situations that should be called the same if they believe that that's there. I don't believe on the face the charge that they're making, you know, for profit. They're saying that there's existing conflicts of interest and so forth. If that's the case, there are already existing arrangements and contracts, existing law that can already take care of all that stuff. I mean, it's a red herring argument, and it's easily dismissed, and it should be.
All right, and so this last one that you've already mentioned is the one I was looking forward to getting to, and what is that exactly again?
Well, a constant charge of people who do not support parental choice is that the schools that receive state money, like in the form of vouchers or any other way, are not accountable. They're not accountable in the same way that traditional public schools are, and they try to raise questions that parents should have doubts about the credibility of the education.
It's a little too free market for them, maybe.
That's where I think that's going, man. So that's the charge, that they lack accountability. Now, that can easily be addressed in that it's simply not true. And you can look at the specific legislation for various programs, but by and large, there are each of these programs that receive state money, and we're talking about all three of them. There are numerous regulations that they have to abide by. For starters, any program that receives state money here will have to abide by federal safety and discrimination regulations. That's a given. Also, in the case of the Opportunity Scholarship Program, schools that receive, I forget the exact number of scholarships, but a certain threshold for recipients are subject to an annual audit. You know, how the money is used, making sure it's spent wisely, et cetera. The schools also have to report academic progress to the legislature and also to parents on how students are doing. Now, the other problem with this is that it assumes that there's, when people are making this charge, it's usually traditional public school advocates. And the problem with the charge is that it assumes that there's only one form of accountability, and that is that it emanates from the state, and that it's usually some form of state regulation. That's flawed, and because there are many forms of accountability. In this particular case, and in the case of school choice, the main form of accountability is parents.
It's voting with your dollar. Voting.
That's right.
Just from a free market perspective, a plumber. You go to a plumber. You have a bad plumber. You don't use the plumber. Everyone has this. Who does go to the plumber has this experience. No one goes to the plumber anymore. You know, word of mouth spreads that Billy Joe Plumber is not a good plumber. Is it not the same for this? You know, the parents, they go to the school. They talk. They realize this is not where we want our kid to be. They pull their kid out, go to a different school. Word gets around. This school suffers because it's not up to par.
That's very much the case. And in fact, private schools, because they derive a very high percentage of their operating expenses from tuition, have to be much more sensitive to parental concerns than traditional public schools, who get tax dollars, you know, and that's really not dependent upon how parents feel at all. So that is really a significant form of accountability that they totally ignore.
They're much more accountable in a direct way than a public school. It seems a public school, it takes, you have to go and get things to go filter up to the top, to come down, to go through all this, like a Plinko board of getting from your complaint from the school your child goes to, getting your complaint up to the top and down to something to do it, be done about it on a local level, versus you as a parent directly to the private school who you are directly paying to offer a service of educating your child in a way that you find to be acceptable. It seems like a much more direct kind of accountability.
It is much more direct. And the other question that needs to be asked here is, all right, if you assume that the form of accountability that they're, you know, laying out, so that should exist. I mean, let's ask the question that needs to be asked: has it worked? If it has worked, I really don't think we'd be talking about the expansion of school choice in the last 20 years. You know, that's not to say that there aren't great public schools. I always say this, but the whole issue here is, what about kids trapped in failing schools? Do they have a voice? And that's what we're talking about. We're talking about, how do you best address their educational needs? And if we're talking about accountability, we have to look and evaluate have the systems worked? And I think we don't have to sit here and scratch our heads for too long to know that our current system of public school accountability has not worked.
Exactly. And I mean, it brings to mind for me a point that you've made, where this is all choice. This is all giving parents options. It's not shutting down public schools. It's not pulling kids and just ripping them out of public school. It's giving parents a choice at the end of the day. And that's what you've said. And I want to thank you for coming on and telling us about this, these different arguments to be made for people who are in these discussions in their daily life with people who want to paint them as anti-public school people when that's not necessarily the case. They want to paint these school choice programs with a negative brush, and you're telling them how not to, and thank you for doing that.
It's good to be here, man.
All right, thank you to Bob for coming on the show and talking with us about all those points we can use when people are bringing anti-school choice arguments or are questioning school choice and those programs. Thank you to Bob for that. Thank you to you, the listeners, and we'll catch you next time.